Have you been wanting to bring your home games to the next level? Maybe you're looking for the perfect holiday gift for the TTRPG-loving person in your life. Well, during the Hero Forge Black Friday sale, you can get savings as big as the stories you tell. Maybe you're a DM and you want to gift something physical to your players of their player characters in your campaign. Or maybe you're a player and you want to give the gift of an NPC in the form of a miniature. You can save 20% on physical miniatures and accessories, such as their iconic color plastic miniatures, their new, super cute custom acrylic keychains, or their 3D printed custom dice, as well as 50% on digital miniatures and STL files. The sale ends December 1st, so don't delay! Restrictions apply. Head to heroforge.com/sale for more details.
Hey, Elliot.
Hey, Brian.
What's the talk of the table?
Today, we're sitting down with Devin Chulik, the founder and CEO of Start Playing. Devin, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here.
Good to have you.
We've been excited to talk to you on Talk at the Table for a little while now and really dig into Start Playing games.
Oh my gosh. Listen, anytime I could shill for Start Playing, I'll be there.
Well, let's give you that opportunity right now. We're going to dive into a lot in this conversation, talking about making a living in TTRPGs, paid GMing, how your company has grown and evolved, and what that player base looks like. But to start off, just to table set, can you tell anyone who doesn't already know, what is Start Playing?
Start Playing is the largest platform for finding games, groups, and game masters for any tabletop game.
Nailed it.
Short, sweet, to the point.
I've never said that ever before. That was off the cuff. I just came up with that.
No, yeah. It felt really off the cuff and just
so
totally natural.
Natural.
I'm curious, when it comes to kind of digging in on that, what was your mission at founding? And has that mission stayed the same or has it kind of evolved over time?
So it's funny. The mission statement that we were like, we say, let's come up with a mission statement. And I shot one out there like, that's really good. Let's see. And we kept going. We tried to come up with something better. And it's funny when you like the first thing was the best thing. But we felt like it can't be the first thing we came up with. Like it has to, we in a brainstorm, it can't be the first thing you say. You got to keep going, right? But the first thing was build communities through play. And that's what our mission statement is. And we literally toyed for like a month and a half trying to think of a better one. And we're like, that's what we do. That's literally what Start Playing is about, building communities through play. And it hasn't really changed.
It is the thing that we talk about a lot on this show is how important it is, whether you are a producer of an actual play, whether you are a designer of a game, to build that community around you and how impactful that can be in making a sustainable career. And I think, it's great to see that in a mission statement from day one. One of the things that I think that you would be able to help us to do as the founder and CEO of Start Playing is, can you help us dispel the myth that paid GMing is bad for the hobby in any way?
Yeah, it's actually really bad for the hobby because it allows more people to get into the hobby. So it's no longer just for the select few. That's a big thing, you know. It allows for more access.
I've got all these gates here I want to keep.
that's the price. It's really bad for gates. No, I mean, if you want the hobby to thrive, that's exactly what pro GMing does. I mean, I've continually told people, and I truly believe this, that we haven't even started the golden era of tabletop role-playing games. I think that, we're probably 10 years away from that. But I think it is something that we're going to come upon, and I think pro GMing is one of the things that's going to help usher that in. I think the internet has already done so much for allowing access to tabletop role-playing games. I think we're going to continue to see more people move into online play because it just allows for so much more easy access to folks that just don't have the time or folks that don't have people to play with near them. And having a facilitator, a host, someone who's actually, rallying everyone together, that pro that's going to do all the work to put the game together is essential to making sure it happens. And a pro GM is putting all that work into it, and it also allows for the folks that are not really heavily invested in that type of play to not participate. You might have like a Ted at the table who they don't really care about the game. They care about the friends, and they are there because they want to be near their friends, but the friends are there because they care about the game. And sometimes those two don't interact well. And so they might detract from the game, they might lose attention, they might pull attention away from the game, and then that makes the game less fun for other people. When you say, hey, it's $15 to be here, that person's like, well, you know what, I'll hang out with my friends with something else. And that means that everyone that's at that table is invested for the same reasons or the same amount. And I think that allows for the experience to also be more entrenched with everyone's kind of like core reason for being there.
Everyone's coming in already serious about it and like on a level playing field. You said something in there about that you think we're still like 10 years away from the golden age of TTRPGs. And that just, my immediate thought was like, well, what does that look like? You know, and in your head, is what do you think doesn't exist right now, either in tabletop role-playing games, in the ability to play, that you hope will exist in the next decade? And how is Start Playing, like, you know, kind of helping you to get there?
So, you know, if you look at what Roll20 was 10 years ago and what Roll20 is today, vastly different. Roll20 paved the way for virtual tabletops. But when they started, they built on a lot of technology that is irrelevant now. And so they had to rebuild a lot of their core product to essentially replatform to make themselves faster, more competitive, and so. But you can build. I mean, there's so many people that are building virtual tabletops today. That you, someone, a new person builds a virtual tabletop every month and is, you know, on Reddit like, hey, look what I built. Technology is getting easier to build tools for tabletop. If you look at a game like Mothership, which is, you know, just a chef's kiss of a game, right? But they've made some amazing virtual tools for their game as well. I think the access to building tools like that is going to become easier because the technology to build that is also becoming more accessible as well. What used to take, you know, a development team of five now can take a development team of one to build. And so I think as more games begin to be able to build tools like this, it's going to make the play more accessible, and it's going to make the play more fun, more immersive. And so I think a lot of the digital tools that we'll see in 10 years are going to lead to a lot of that.
I did just play my first ever game of Mothership not too long ago, and someone told me to use the Mothership companion app, which I know like won an Annie and stuff. I just assumed it was like a character builder. It had maps. It was a very
it's
cool
so good.
It really felt it's like so one of those good. Few moments where I was like, I'm living in the future, man. It's just like a really good fucking app.
I know. Kudos to the Tuesday Night crew.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They really nailed it with that one.
So to kind of dig in more on this idea of professional GMing for folks listening at home, I'm curious, when you look across the people who've gotten on the platform, is there something that you see in common with successful GMs on your platform? Are there commonalities, common traits, common things these folks are doing?
Yeah. They care about customer service. They understand that there's this like soft skills part about, you know, it's not just like, I'm a great GM, show up and play. They're like, hey, like I'm providing a service. I'm going to be a service provider. So that involves having that customer service touch. That really can separate a good GM to a great GM when it comes to like the professional side of things. It's also people that are willing to take feedback. You know, sometimes I see GMs who will receive feedback from a player and they get really defensive about it. And it's because they've been a home GM for so long with players that are just like, hey, this is the only game I get. I'm going to be happy with it. This is great. When people say like they want a little bit more, they're not really receptive to feedback. They don't have that kind of like growth mentality. That's not something we typically see with very successful GMs. So people that are like, you know, like they want feedback, they want to improve, they want to become better. That is a great aspect of a pro GM. People who have that kind of customer service soft skills is a great part of a GM. And people who are willing to experiment and try things. You know, I always tell people there's no such thing as a silver bullet or an arrow of slain when it comes to pro GMing. It's 1,000 crossbow bolts. That's how you succeed. You know, it's not one thing that's going to tip you over. It's all the things that build up. It's greater than the sum of their parts.
No one's rolling a D20. Everyone's rolling just a bunch of D4s over and over again.
Exactly. You know, it's just this dice. You're just chipping away.
I love that you mentioned feedback in there, because I feel like that's one of the tools that you're giving, like, your community, like, this idea of community to make sure that their experience stays positive. Like, the players are empowered to give the GMs feedback. So on that side of things, how does the player experience and player input make sure that kind of only the GMs who care that much are able to find success?
It's really funny, right? Like, I remember someone asked me, why do I never see any 2-star GMs on Start Playing? I was like, because they have 2 stars and they stopped running games. Like, nobody's booking, like, you know, like, why don't you see any, like, 2-star Airbnbs? Because, like, the person was running a slum, you know, like, but we also have, like, a lot of policies in place to make sure that, like, reviews aren't being weaponized. Because, you know, I don't want to live in a world that is, reviews are like Yelp, where it's like, oh, well, good luck, you know, where it's just like, you know, you have to deal with a lot of, I guess, weaponized reviews is the best way to put it. So we have a lot of policies in place of like, hey, you know, if you think a review is being weaponized, or, you know, on the player side, the GM, you know, sometimes a player has been removed from a game because broke a code of conduct, or they did something that made the other players uncomfortable. And we've seen they go immediately and they try to flame the GM in reviews. And we interviewed the other players in that table and like, yeah, this guy like crossed a bunch of lines. We all felt really uncomfortable by it. And we're like, okay, we kind of realize what happened here. But that's because we have this great team that like goes in and has to do a lot of like human investigation. You know, we can't just make a lot of this automated decisions. It's a lot of nuance. But think about this, like never before have like GMs had all of these testimonials about people's experience playing with them. You have GMs that have hundreds of reviews. You know, I think the average GM has like 23 reviews. And you can see like how many times a player has played with them. It's like, oh, this person's played with this GM for 312 sessions, and this is what they think of them. That's pretty cool. And to see like they also rate this person as a great teacher of the game, and they're also really great with the rule of cool, and you can kind of see what the other players give the proficiencies of that GM. So there's this amazing way to see like how GMs and their play style and the way that they're received by players. And that's also great for GMs. They can say, hey, look, this is what my players think of me.
I'm curious to kind of put some numbers behind what paid GMing looks like. Can you tell me what, to whatever degree you want to share, what an average GM makes? What is kind of the amount of money that someone can ideally make if they are a 5-star GM doing this professionally? And someone who just wants to do this, you know, kind of part-time.
So the it's funny because the average price of a game is $18 to $20. But that's because the longer you're a GM, the more money you end up making. So like the top line we see is like $30 to $50 a player. And like the longer you're on the platform, the more players you have, the longer you're running campaigns, we see those prices go up. So people might join the platform. They start at $10, $15, $20. And then the longer they're there, they start charging more and more and more. But when they start, so that's kind of why the price floats around 18 to 20 is because new people join and they start a little lower. And then as they get older, yeah. But I mean, overall, since we started in 2020, GMs have earned over $50 million running games, which just a wild number to think about.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
That's certainly that's not nothing.
Someone is indeed making a living on that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and I would say probably like I think when I was talking to Jenny D, it's hard to tell like how many GMs are making a full-time living because we can't get a full survey where everyone answers. But if we look at how much people are earning and maybe guesstimate like if that is if that is enough to be full time wherever they live, I would probably say 15 to 20% of GMs.
Wow.
Wow, even as a ballpark estimate, that's a great number.
So, I'm curious for someone who is listening to this and just heard those numbers and got really excited. Which I'm sure there's like a lot of people out there. I know that this is not, I couldn't GM that much. I'm not the right fit. But I'm sure someone out there is like, this sounds amazing. I want to do this right now. I'm curious, like, what does that life look like? Like, to be able to be in that echelon, what is the amount of games you need to run? What are the tools that you should be investing in that players really like to see? What are the steps you should be doing from day one to get into that world if you're really interested in it and if you think that's like a great move for you?
I think the best advice, that's actually great. Like if you end up joining as a GM on Start Playing, first you have to take fill out an application. If you pass the application, which is kind of like, hey, can you follow instructions, right? It's real basic stuff. It's like, hey, do you understand our policy? Do you understand what to do, what not to do? Do you have good customer service skills? Can you do good kind of arbitration between players kind of stuff? But after that, you get welcome to an onboarding, which is kind of like, here's the best practices. But then there's also like I have 100 tips that I give to any GM, to, like how to succeed. And one of those is, don't try to start full-time. You got to work your way up there. If you try to say like, I'm going to be full-time by the end of this month, it's really hard to happen. You have to hustle incredibly hard. And I think you'd burn out before you could even do that in a month. The hardest part is getting that first table. So focus on that first table, lean on your friends, do everything you can to get that first table and you kind of grow from there. But as far as tech, I see full-time GMs using all kinds of different tech. I see some that are using physical battle maps still instead of a VTT. Some are using Roll20. Some are using Alba Rodeo. Some are using Foundry or Fantasy Runs, like the entire gamut of VTTs. And some are just using Theater of the Mind. So I always tell GMs, how can you run your best game ever? If you can run your best game ever using Theater of the Mind, then run that. Because there's players out there that don't care for VTT, but they love Theater of the Mind, and they're going to come back if you can run your best game ever doing that. But if you're trying to run a game on Roll20 and you can't run your best game ever that way, you're going to run a bad game, and people aren't going to want to come back. So how can you run your best game ever?
I'm curious because you mentioned in there that some people use like physical battle maps, and this is a question I actually don't know the answer to. Do Start Playing games ever make their way offline while still being connected to the platform?
Great question. So we have noticed a number. So when we first started building Start Playing, we built in like a zip code finder right away because we were like, well, after this 6-week lockdown, people are going to want to play in person. God. So 14 weeks in, we're like, we should probably just scrap this, huh? But we plan to revisit in person in 2026. But we do see people currently using it because it's also a great way of like, people who are running in-person games right now, they don't have to worry about tracking people down for payment. If you sign up for the game and Start Playing, like it auto-charges them, so they don't have to like worry about collecting. And then they also shows like how many times that person has played, so it's great on the review. So we see a lot of people use us for their in-person games as well. We just did also an in-person event in Chicago, which was very cool, with a company called Wizard Staffing Co. So we hope to do more in-person stuff and hopefully a big push in 2026. But right now, it's just kind of like a la carte. Some people are kind of just, they're kind of for, square peg, round hole.
Yeah, hacking the platform a bit for it, yeah.
In terms of the people who, the players, the customer base, how long do people generally, I'm curious what the like lifespan, but also the life cycle of a Start Playing customer is. Like, do people find games on Start Playing and then continue to play on Start Playing? Or do they eventually migrate off the platform either to home games or just like separate games? Is one preferable to the other?
The retention is wild. People usually end up playing forever with their first GM. It's like something like a 16-month retention.
Wow.
Yeah. And usually like they'll find the right GM the first time and they stick with that GM for the majority of their time on the platform.
Wow. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
That's not what I would expect. I feel like I had this like when I like from the outside, I've GM'd one small campaign on Start Playing when we did the Wild Sea, I ran it. But like my imagined user experience was like somebody starts playing via Start Playing and then eventually moves off the platform. So that's really cool to hear that people kind of stick with someone for that long.
I mean, it's one of those things, when you realize how hard it is to find a game, right? You go and you're in a Facebook group and you're trying to find a game. You're like, this is a nightmare. And then you've joined 15 Discord servers and the campaign that you're hoping to join fell apart before it actually even had its first session. And then you filled out a bunch of applications in Reddit and then you never heard back. And then you finally found a game on Start Playing and it happened and you had fun and you're like, oh my gosh, this feels like magic. And I hear this all the time. And it's funny because sometimes like I'll look at Reddit and there'll be posts like, is Start Playing legit? Like they'll be, but then I look at the comments and people are like, this is like, I can't believe it happened. Like I've been always wanting to find the game. I finally did. People recommending it, like this has literally solved the problem. And so, and that's why, and like, if people do need to find another game, you know, because the game fell apart, like we see the rebook happen really often because like my problem was solved. And they know that like, if something happened, Start Playing's there to fix it. You know, like, oh, hey, you know, like this GM, you know, went way off the path. We all feel uncomfortable. They know that there's going to be consequences for that. And that we're going to keep the player community safe, but also the GMs know we're going to keep the GM community safe and remove a player if they're also, you know, breaking code of conduct or the terms of service, et cetera.
Yeah, we've all read, you know, D&D horror stories on Reddit. It's good to know that there's like a potential for somebody to have, not that I want anybody to have a bad first experience role-playing, but that doesn't have to be the end of their role-playing career like you sometimes hear it is for people. So that's
yeah. How much of a bummer is that? And here's the thing.
Yeah.
There's no way to avoid, like, there's no way, like, the human condition, there's always going to be shitty people. But one of our goals is to continually find ways to remove that component and that opportunity as much as possible within reason so that the first experience you have is likely to be the best experience possible.
I'm really thinking about one of my favorite podcasts is not another D&D podcast, but their like sub show called Dungeon Court. That's just it's my favorite part of that show. But it's just people, for anyone who doesn't know, it's people writing in with like their horror stories or complaints about a D&D game or like rules questions, and then they'll arbitrate. And a lot of the ones that are just like shitty people, the final advice ends up being like, get new friends, which is always like a really tough advice. It is interesting that like, I didn't even think about Start Playing as being a safety net or just like an overseeing thing that can be an impartial third party observer that is like, hey, actually something went wrong here. Let's fix it together. Because here's the thing. It used to be the fact like, well, the local game store is the only group I can have. So I'm going to deal with it. This guy just is kind of shitty, and you don't have to. You don't have to deal with a shitty game master or a shitty player. You deserve better.
We all deserve better. Well, I want to dig in a bit on that because you mentioned something earlier about how, like, in the case sometimes you have to have people go in and interview players and like that, there's a human touch there. Whereas I could imagine somebody might see the platform and be like, I don't know where the people behind Start Playing are, but you've got people who are doing this very human work to correct this. Can you talk about the team that you've had to form over the years to make all this happen behind the scenes?
Dudes, it's so funny. People think that like the company is just me, and some people think the company is like 100 people. It's so funny. Like... so if you're listening, I'm going to put the record straight. Because also, game masters go onto LinkedIn and they put us as their employer. So if you look at us, people are like, oh, Start Playing is a company of 500 people or more. And so people are like, I would like to sell you enterprise services for your... I'm like, listen, I don't need that. I don't have that many employees. So, but we have a team of 9. So we are a small company, right? We are a small startup. I am definitely a hire begrudgingly because I never want to overhire. I don't want to be the CEO that lays people off. There's this idea that, you know, usually in some startups, like you hire as much as possible to grow as fast as possible, to build as quickly as possible, and then lay off as necessary. And I more want to like have a team that's going to like stretch ourselves, build as much as we can, be very, very smart about it. Everyone have as much input as possible. And then when we get to the point where like, hey, listen, like we need to bring on that next person, those next 3 people, we do. And so that's how we've kind of built it. So we have, you know, a pretty small engineering team, a small customer team. It's just me for, you know, the you know, a product and marketing, and then a pretty small design and ops team.
And it's interesting because you've got this small sort of lean tech company in a lot of ways, I think you would describe, in, you know, the gaming sphere. And I'm curious, like, how Is everyone at Start Playing a gaming fan? Is that like the kind of people, like the people who end up working on a project like this? Is it like, are they also making a living in TTRPGs to pull back to our core theme?
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. We just had our company offsite, right? Which is, you know, once a year, because the company is mostly remote. So it's great to get together, but, you know, there's half the team is, you know, like in the kitchen where we're staying, or like the dining room playing Commander. The other, you know, we're playing a board game. So everyone loves games. We played one of the folks on our customer team, Hunter. He's also one of the professors at D&D and Castles Dungeon Master University. He ran a tournament, a PvP tournament for us. I was like, I don't know if a PvP is good for team building. He's like, it's going to be great, trust me. where we all, we just fought each other in a 1v1 till we ended up in another kind of like a tournament bout. And so, you know, we love games. And it's not like it's necessary to have to work there. Like, I would still hire someone amazing if they don't love games, but they love the product. But it just so happens that everyone does, like, thoroughly love tabletop games, or they love this industry in some way.
And which team won the 1v1 tournament?
Eng did. Our senior lead did. Yeah. It was me. Actually, it was down to me and him. And I was blown away. I literally there was no chance. I was annihilated.
Hell yeah.
Have you been wanting to bring your home games to the next level? Maybe you're looking for the perfect holiday gift for the TTRPG-loving person in your life. Well, during the Hero Forge Black Friday sale, you can get savings as big as the stories you tell. Maybe you're a DM and you want to gift something physical to your players of their player characters in your campaign. Or maybe you're a player and you want to give the gift of an NPC in the form of a miniature. You can save 20% on physical miniatures and accessories, such as their iconic color plastic miniatures, their new, super cute custom acrylic keychains, or their 3D printed custom dice, as well as 50% on digital miniatures and STL files. The sale ends December 1st, so don't delay! Restrictions apply. Head to heroforge.com/sale for more details. Hey campers, have you heard of season 5 of 5 GMs in a Trenchcoat from Inside the Tent? You haven't? Well, let us tell you about it.
A nice, green, natural regional park. This is Hidden Falls Regional Park. For our purposes in our world, it's a bit larger than it actually is. It is the summer of 1983, and it is all of your first time getting to stay at Hidden Falls.
We promise it's going to be a great time. It's going to be a story of three childhood friends going across the Americas in 1987 using Kids on Bikes 2nd edition. So grab a blanket, make some coffee. The first 3 episodes are available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Want to transition a little bit into something that we talk about on the show all the time, which is like expanding the horizons of gamers and like exposing people to more games. And obviously, like, pro GMing, even maybe a few years ago, people would have just said pro DMing because they would have only been thinking of one game, Dungeons and Dragons. And I'm curious how you see Start Playing's role in like expanding the horizon of the kinds of games people play and like the different TTRPGs people play.
Start Playing is the answer to get more people to play other games. I know that sounded way more arrogant than I wanted to, but we found that like when we've worked with publishers, with a simple like event, we saw City of Mist go from the 53rd most popular game on the platform to like the 13th.
Oh, wow.
Just by an event. And what that means is we say, GMs, this publisher wants to do an event with us. They're going to give you a free version of the game if you run a session of it and you schedule one out. And they're also going to tell their entire audience that this is happening. GM's like, oh, this is great. I've always wanted to run City of Mist. Yeah, of course I'm going to put up a session. A lot of these GMs already have a community. And they're like, hey, I'm going to be running this City of Mist game. A lot of players are like, oh my gosh, I would love to try that. Because here's the thing. Players love their GM. And if the GM loves a game, they're going to want to try that. The thing is, the players aren't as stuck in a system. We've noticed as they are stuck with their GM. They really love their GM. And there's something about, like, if they're having a great experience and they really trust the GM and the GM's, like, excited about something, they'll want to try that. And, of course, there's some people that, you know, don't want to go out of their comfort zone. And that's fine, you know. But we notice if a GM runs one game and players come to them from that game, but they also run another, there is a really likely drift that will happen where that player will experiment with other systems. And that is only exemplified or that's only expanded if that GM participates in a publisher event.
I know it's a thing that we say a lot about growing audiences in anything is that people don't follow shows, people don't follow formats, people don't follow even games. People follow people. Like when you get excited about a person and want to spend time with them, either in a parasocial actual play way or in a, this is my GM, I want to follow them where they're going, that's the strongest relationship you're going to have. And that's going to be the one that changes the way you behave more than anything else.
Yeah. And inventory is a big thing, right? Because here's the thing, there's you know, 7,923 tabletop RPGs that have ever been made. I counted them individually earlier today. but not everyone can you find a game for. But if a publisher who makes that game is like, hey, let's get people excited about this game. They have an audience that wants to play this game. They're on a newsletter because they like the game. They probably bought it. They probably backed it on Kickstarter just to have it sit on a shelf like I have behind me that you guys can see, but the listeners can't, that they've never cracked. I mean, if I look here, I have, I'm actually pretty good at it. There's only eight books here that I haven't played, but I'm blessed.
All right, like, it's impressive.
It would be embarrassing. It'd be embarrassing if I, you know, like, right. But when a publisher is like, hey, I'm going to send this audience because they want to play the game that we've sold them that we make. Here's a bunch of GMs that are ready to run it. And GMs are excited to run it because they know the publisher is going to send a excited audience to them. So that kind of partnership stuff, it lets these more niche games or indie games really thrive on Start Playing.
This is maybe just like a good calling all publishers, let Start Playing know if you want them to play your game. It seems to be a pretty good way to get people to play some games.
It costs them like almost nothing. Like just give the games away for free to the GMs. I don't charge publishers for this. I'm not going to build a business model that involves charging publishers.
Interesting. That was going to be my next question, was what does this partnership look like for publishers? Is there like a kind of publisher, or I guess in a selfish perspective, a size of publisher that you would say makes the most sense for these kinds of partnerships?
I mean, we've worked with everyone from, you know, we're working with Free League right now. I mean, Brian, I was talking to you. I need Brian to make some creative for the Alien Evolved launch that we're having next week. Of course, we worked with Daggerheart. You know, I think it's kind of like the size of the publisher. We need to know that they have at least an audience big enough to bring to the GMs. And then depending on the size and effort that they can put behind it, also determines how much dollars we'll actually put behind the event as well. So we'll sometimes put marketing spend behind these events by hiring folks like Brian and other, you know, creators to create social content to promote the event or to create ads that also drive people to these games. It's always funny. I often hear GMs say, I wish you'd do more for indie games. I'm like, we do a lot. And the thing is, we're going to continue to do a lot. It's just there's only so much we can do with the bandwidth we have. And so we have to be very pointed and direct. And so, but the publishers help us make the most impact. And so Daggerheart, not only did they have us get a shout out on Critical Role with Matt Mercer talking about, hey, you can find a game of Daggerheart, which is great. But then we were able to hire all these amazing creators to also promote the event. So it's kind of it really is a partnership, you know, like we're willing to put in dollars to make this successful because the publisher is willing to really put as much effort as they can behind it.
And I'm kind of curious, like just more on like the game designer and publisher perspective, is there a kind of game that you think is most attractive to the start playing model, or like when people, not that I don't think anybody would, when they sit down to design their game, be like, I'm going to design my game for start playing. But like, is there, when a publisher is considering a game that might make sense for this kind of partnership, is there a kind of game that you think works particularly well with the platform?
I can maybe only tell you the game that doesn't.
Sure.
GMless.
Yeah. That makes sense.
There's a lot of games that like, I see GMs trying to run, and they're a little bit, but I do see like some GMs running like Ghosts of the Discord, right? Which like, they're like, I'm going to organize this for everyone. And like, I'll kind of be like the host and moderator, and walk you through it, which, you know, is interesting. Cause like that kind of works, you know, like, Alice is Missing, you know, like that actually works surprisingly well. Elliot, your newest game would be a little bit harder.
Yeah, for sure.
Right. But there are some GMs who are great duet GMs who I think would kind of crush it, you know, with the time we have, which is out now if you're looking to get it. Great game for two players. Simple plug.
Thank you very much.
There's the standard edition, also the very fancy collector's edition.
Yeah. All right.
So I think right now Start Playing still really thrives in your classic, you know, referee player style game. But I don't know what the future is going to look like. And I really would love to solve board games. But digital board games is hard in person. Like, I hire people all the time when I play a board game at Gen Con. Like, I don't know. I don't want to read the rules. Just tell me how it plays. Like, can I give you $50 to come and just sit here and just tell us what to do on our turns? And I kind of like that. But not everyone's like that. So I don't know how we can help with board games or GMless games. But, you know, a lot of people love The Quiet Year, and they run that on Start Playing. So there is this space for it.
Do you have any statistics or just kind of like general trends that you've seen since the inception of Start Playing to now of what I'm kind of looking for is like a pie chart percentage of like D&D versus, I want to say indie games, but really what I mean to say is non-D&D games. And have you seen anything particularly come to the forefront or like make its way to the front of the pack from the indie sphere?
Yeah. I mean, Daggerheart has made a huge splash.
Sure.
You know, I would say Daggerheart is probably on its way to becoming the second most popular game on the platform. It's really running up there, getting really close to kind of Pathfinder numbers. But every time I hear people talk about the idea of a D&D killer, that doesn't exist. You know, you need another 30 years of nostalgia of a different game for that to be the case. And D&D is still the leading driver of growth for other games. Like I said, like, the game that drives the most new users is still D&D, but GMs who run D&D in other games still have the highest amount of drift into other games. So the best way to the best way to see other games played is by a player joining a D&D game. And that's because most players have no idea these other games exist. And it's such a turnoff when they're like, oh, I want to play D&D. It's like, no, you don't. No, you don't. You don't want to play D&D. And they're like, I didn't know you know, like, right? So it's like,
I swear.
Yeah. Just let people enjoy their things, right? But at the same time, you know, I've done these user interviews, and I was watching this user go through the site, and they're like, oh, yeah, I want to learn to play D&D. Oh, no, I want to play this game. And they booked Avatar The Last Airbender. It's like, I know everything about that. That's one of my favorite shows. I want to book this. And they didn't really know it was a different system, that they love the IP. And so they booked that. And they're like, oh, like, that's okay. Like, I'll figure out the rules. But like, I know the lore really well. So like, I feel really confident booking this game. And so there's something to be said about like really popular IPs, like standing on their own legs. But everything else, like, it's going to grow because someone is introduced into the hobby through D&D usually. And then they explore other systems. And that's truly where we've seen the most growth into third-party systems. We've seen more growth from I started D&D and then to another system.
I really long, I think, especially because we produce an actual play podcast that is all indie games, you know, in My First Dungeon. We all and like most of the shows on network, long for that day when we can say actual play podcast or like TTRPG podcast, and that mean the same thing, and not ever have to see someone say like D&D podcast to describe a podcast playing the Wild Sea or something.
Yeah. yeah.
So it is a thing that I'm very aware of, that like D&D is always, I don't want to say always, but is for the very foreseeable future going to be that 1,000-pound elephant in the room.
Iconically synonymous, you know.
But I do long for that future. I do long for that future where it's, hey, I want to learn to play a tabletop role-playing game. Let's go see what the options are, rather than, I want to play D&D.
And someone's like, oh, I don't know what that is, but I would like to play D&D, please. I'm like, yeah, here you go. Here's some D&D games. And the thing is, like, the magic I notice is people play that, and like, that was really cool. But it would be really cool if there was, like, a D&D in space, and someone's like, oh, well, there's this game called Alien. They're like, oh, I love that. I'm like, yeah, it's like D&D, but it's that. I'm like, oh, I'll play, like, it's not that people are averse, like a lot of new to the hobby are averse to D&D. They're just like, they can't be overwhelmed with like content and facts. Like, there's actually this really interesting thing I tell GMs is, if you are running a beginner game, make sure that your copy and the way you're about your adventure is also really accessible. If you say, you know, join the Emerald Enclave and try to defeat the Red Wizards of Thay before they take down Neverwinter. I was in a user interview and a player was looking at beginner-friendly games and they saw this one, like, oh, this is too advanced for me. And I was like, why? This is a beginner, it's marked beginner-friendly. Like, oh, I don't know these people, so I need to find something earlier. And I was like, oh, it's like the proper nouns are throwing them off.
Right, just say noble knights defeat evil wizards in place.
Yeah. And so
fascinating.
So like, if you imagine, like, if that is the cognitive load that is too much, trying to then explain to someone the breadth of tabletop role-playing games, and then say like, no. Okay, so imagine the entire planet has been overtaken by a living tree organism, and you're a sky pirate, and you're trying to explain the Wild Sea, and the person's like, I'm sorry, what? You know, like, so we don't throw people into Twilight Imperium. We start with Catan.
Sure.
I know the way that I always talk about it, especially for like getting people into actual play, is like, you've got to get over the activation energy. Like, and once you get past that activation energy, it's literally all downhill. But you've got to find the way to reduce that activation energy as much as possible so that everything is easy and downhill.
You mentioned insights in there, Devin, a couple of times from these user interviews, and I found particularly just that one about proper nouns to be so interesting and delightful. Is there anything else that like people would find surprising about like user behavior you've learned on the platform and like what it can tell us about teaching people games or bringing people into the hobby?
People desperately want to know who the GM is. They're reading between the lines. They're like trying to figure out like, but they also don't want to read too much. So it's this dance you have to do of like, be really clear about who you are. There's actually this, when I had time, I used to do like the onboardings where I tell like best practices to GMs. And there was this talk I saw at a South By, I think that's where it was. And this woman was saying like, she was just getting terrible matches on Hinge or Tinder. And so she had this idea to try to get more, to get better matches. And so she changed her very first image to be her in a shirt that said, if you hurt animals, I'll hurt you. Because she was an animal rights activist. She was a vegan. And she noticed that one change like dramatically shifted her matches to other people who like shared a similar ideology. Conversations also prompted like, oh yeah, no, I'm also a PETA member or animal rights, or you know, I'm also vegan, things like that. And what it did is people were self-opting out to be like, oh, I like bacon. I don't want to match with you. Like that's what began to happen. And so I tell that to GMs, like, if you can make it so that you are really clear about who you are, right? Like, I'm not going to run tactical games. I'm not going to run really heavy tactical combat heavy games. The person who wants that is going to be like, you're not for me. But the person who wants that, who is okay with that, they're going to be like, you're the right GM for me. And that's why the best GMs are really good at explaining who they are. And that's why when people book with a GM, they stay 14 to 16 months with that GM because it's really clear who they are.
Dating apps is a really good parallel. Like, not to imply there's anything, any sort of romantic intentions between GM and player, but like, it is a very good kind of parallel for thinking about presenting yourself as a person.
Yeah, it's funny. It's just like that self-opting out behavior is really valuable. If you could just make it really clear, like, this is who I am, this is what I value, this is what you're going to get.
I think that is also, it kind of piggybacks on like that adage of like, if you try to make something for everyone, you're making it for no one. Like, if you try to make your pitch too broad, you're not going to reach anyone because no one knows exactly what you're trying to
do. You don't
want
to catch all the fish in the sea. You want to catch the right fish. I don't know how this metaphor works, but you know what I mean.
There's fish. You want certain ones. Yeah.
There's fish.
Yeah, you want the cod for the fish tacos. You don't want the, you know.
Devin, as we kind of round out this conversation, one of the things I'd love to hear from you is, I'm sure because Start Playing is about creating gaming groups and gaming groups are about creating stories, I would imagine that there are some great stories from gaming groups that you've heard over the past couple of years. Are there any particular highlights that you can recall of great stories of epic sessions or like great stories of gaming groups becoming, you know, friends for life or anything like that?
Some of the great ones. I remember there was a group of fifth grade girls that were in a group, and their moms ended up having their own group. So like all the moms of the fifth grade girls like played in a monthly group as well to like see what it was like, and they ended up having a blast. I thought that was really cute. Two people met at a game ended up getting married, and the GM officiated that wedding. That was really cool.
Oh, wow.
You know?
That's so great.
One of our GMs got a tattoo of our logo, which was crazy. That's a check mark, a bucket list thing of like you've really made it, that someone got a tattoo of your brand.
You
got
to send that person like a little bonus of something.
I know, yeah, right.
just something.
There's these guys, they all met randomly. They all joined a game separately, and they all became best friends. And they've like traveled to see each other, but they're all going to get matching tattoos. They call themselves the Chonky Boys, like that's their in-game name for their party. And so like that's like, you know, there's a game master only Discord that you get access to after you join as a GM, and there's a channel called Success Stories, and every day I go and I read those, and like there's just some crazy stuff, and it makes me so happy. Like, it's not lost on me like how great this job is and what we get to do, and that people, I mean, it's gig work, right? But it is not DoorDash, it is not Uber, it is people. We like still have to pay rent, and even if the world's on fire, you still have to pay rent and you still have to buy groceries, but people can get a little bit of joy out of that labor, and they can create these communities, and those communities create friendships and joy and belonging, and it's all through play. And it's not lost on me on how great of a feeling that all those communities provide for each other, and it makes me so happy that I get to be a part of that.
I'll add one more to that, of just a friend of ours who I won't name because I don't know if they would want to be, but like a friend of ours ran a long, long running game on Start Playing and then had like kind of a personal disaster where their computer got destroyed or broke or something like that. And one of their long-term multi-year Start Playing players like replaced their computer for them because they were just like, hey, like I really, you know, believe in what you do and want you to be able to keep doing it. So like, and they had the extra money to do so. And it was just, yeah, I remember that, seeing that and being like, that's really special.
Damn. Oh, I love that. I love, yeah, because the thing is like, it's these small communities, right? Like things like Twitch, where one person can have 90% of the views, right? No one Dungeon Master can have 90% of the players on DM. Well, no one GM can have 90% of the players. So the communities, like, they can't get big. They can't get past a certain point. So they have to stay small enough where they still become so impactful that you also see these weird, cool forms of mutual aid forming between them as well. And they go past this idea of just, like, transactional. They become really important. And sometimes people say, it can't be real. You know, you're paying for it. And we pay for all sorts of things throughout our lives. You might buy something from the same bodega every day, but that doesn't mean that that bodega owner isn't someone who becomes a friend, who becomes, you know, part of your community. And the same with the people who own the coffee shop that you see every day. So there's a certain level of where, like, commerce between your community doesn't ruin the fact that you're creating a connection.
I remember I was speaking with our friend Dr. Emily Friedman a while ago about GMing, and you know, and the thing that she said was that GMing is very akin to care work, which is something that for most of human history has been put in a very feminine space and has often been either unpaid or underpaid, more often unpaid than underpaid. And it is great to be able to find community that is able to support the people doing that kind of care work that GMing is most akin to in the way that most people do it.
That's so interesting. I never even thought about that.
I'm also just reminded that I know my wife, when we first met, was doing like a rec soccer league or a rec volleyball league, like through Zog Sports or something. And I'm pretty sure that was like a couple $100 for like a season. This is the fact that there is a Zog Sport league that you pay $200 for does not mean you cannot go play soccer out in the field for free. It just means there are going to be a bunch of people at the field that you know are there.
I know. Like it takes a lot to organize. Listen, I don't want to call a bunch of schools and try to find out which field I can rent. And then, you know, like I want someone else to do that for me. Yeah.
Hell yeah. Well, Devin, we've reached that time in the show where we ask you the question we ask every one of our guests that comes on Talk of the Table. And that is, what are you bringing to the table? And this is just our cute way of asking you for a recommendation to our audience, anything under the sun that you would like to recommend to our listeners today.
Okay. I know everyone's already talked about Shadow Dark. This Shadow Dark has been recommended too much. But I'm going to say it again. Shadow Dark is so good. Playing it really made me feel like I was playing D&D again for the very first time. So I love Shadow Dark. But if you're like, you know what, you need a break, go play Dispatch. It's not a tabletop game, but it's so fun. That's all I'm talking about right now is play Dispatch. It's a really fun video game. Have you guys heard of this?
No, I don't know anything about
Dispatch. I don't know what it is.
Critical Role is part of it. It's a video game. It's like a Telltale choose your own adventure type of game. It's so fun. I'm gonna replay it. I never replay games. I hate replaying. I hate rewatching things. I can't wait till I go home tonight and replay it.
a ringing endorsement, oh, yeah, if I ever heard one. Thank you, Devin, so much for coming to the table. Do you want to let people know before you go where they can find you online and also where they can find Start Playing?
You can find me everywhere online where you can find people at just Devin Chulik. And of course, you can find Start Playing anywhere as well at Start Playing. And of course, our website, startplaying.com.
Hell yes. And if you want more gamey content from us here at Talk of the Table, you can check out the Many-Sided newsletter or talk about this episode and all of our other episodes over on the Many-Sided Media Discord. Both of those are going to be linked in our show notes. And if you want to support this show and help us continue to make Talk of the Table, My First Dungeon, and all the other shows that we make, you can also become a member of the Many-Sided Media Patreon, where you can get access to ad-free episodes, bonus roundtables, cast talkbacks for My First Dungeon, monthly bonus actual plays. We've even released a couple of like short games on there for free and original music. And as always, rate, review, and follow Talk of the Table wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.